everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on. So first thing needs comment again is Gaza. And Israel keeps pounding Gaza, not letting enough humanitarian aid in. It's genocide. And yesterday we got a preliminary ruling from the International Court of Justice on South Africa's charge of genocide against Israel. And it did reject South Africa's appeal for a ceasefire. There are technical reasons for that. But it did find evidence of genocide and allowed the case to move forward, which is going to take at least a couple years. But the International Court of Justice found, quote, real and imminent risk that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. And so it ordered six urgent measures to prevent genocide. It urged Israel to take all measures to prevent acts of genocide from taking place and to ensure its military does not commit violations of the Genocide Convention in Gaza. Third, Israel must punish those who incite genocide. And the South African case made, you know, quoted a lot of Israeli leaders that were inciting genocide and ethnic cleansing. Four, to immediately provide basic services and humanitarian assistance to Gazans, which is, you know, needed right away. Five, to prevent the destruction of evidence that could show violations of international law. And six, Israel's to submit a report to the International Court of Justice in a month on all the steps it has taken to implement the measures in this International Court of Justice order. The ruling also ordered Hamas to release those hostages. Since the IGC or ICJ, the International Court of Justice, deals with disputes between states, and Hamas is not a state, a ceasefire imposed on only one side, Israel, in this conflict wasn't plausible. So that explains why they didn't call for a ceasefire. This case is different than other cases. I mean, I can think of a couple in Ukraine, 2 days after Russia invaded the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Ukraine brought charges of genocide against Russia. Now that was a dispute between states, and the International Court of Justice ordered Russia to cease its military operations in Ukraine. Ukraine filed it on February 26th. They had hearings on March 7th, and the ruling was out by March 16th. And it was a 13-2 vote on the bench, of course, with Russia and the Chinese judges dissenting. And Russia tried to defend itself by saying it was preventing genocide of Russian speakers in Ukraine, but the International Court of Justice dismissed that for lack of any evidence. And, you know, ordered Russia to stop its military operations. So that case continues, and Ukraine is seeking reparations from Russia for its aggression. Ukraine also won a preliminary ruling from the International Court of Justice against Russia in 2017 under the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination for the oppression of the Crimean Tatar people in occupied Crimea. The IGC also, or ICJ, also ordered Syria to stop torturing Syrians just last November in a case brought by Canada and the Netherlands against the Assad dictatorship. That vote, again, was 13-2 with the Russian and Chinese judges dissenting. Now, the problem is, how do you enforce these rulings? The court itself has no enforcement mechanisms, but as part of the United Nations Security Council could take action to enforce these rulings. But of course, Russia would veto any actions proposed in the Ukraine cases. And in the South African case against Israel, the UN Security Council would probably face a veto by the United States, which brings up Article 27.3 in the UN Charter that states that a party to a dispute before the Security Council shall abstain from voting in connection with that dispute. And I brought that up before on this podcast. but none of the Security Council members have had the guts to challenge the big powers that use the veto. Most often it's the US and Russia to enforce that article in the United Nations, but it's something that we should be raising as part of our support for a foreign policy based on human rights, democracy, and international cooperation. And international cooperation has got to include UN reform, even enforcing, you know, like this Article 27.3 of the UN Charter. But going back to the South African case against Israel, to implement those six urgent measures, Israel would have to radically, if not totally, cut back its military operations in Gaza. And there's no indication the response from Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders was they just gave their backhand to this ruling. And the U.S. contention that South Africa's case for genocide was quote unquote meritless was itself shown to be meritless. The court clearly recognized there's evidence for genocide. Its ruling cited the many facts and arguments made by the South Africans and nearly none presented by the Israelis in the hearings. Even the Israeli judge voted with the 16-1 majority on many of the recommended measures. The American judge voted for all of them. The only dissenting judge was from Uganda, and she did it on the dubious grounds of standing and jurisdiction. And the Ugandan government formally distanced itself from her position, but many commentators think she is really representing the behind-the-scenes policy of the Yoweri Museveni family dictatorship in Uganda and their close relationship with Israel, including close collaboration on police state methods of surveillance and social control. And we should remember that South Africa is also preparing to sue the US and the UK for complicity in the genocide in Gaza. So the US has more than one reason to stop arming and providing diplomatic support for Israel's assault on Gaza. The ruling opens the door to action by the UN Security Council to enforce its action. And the question, you know, for the US is, what will it do? Is it going to cover for Israel with another veto? There's some reason to believe, you know, they may have lost patience with Israel. The US CIA Director William Burns is meeting as we speak with his intelligence counterparts from Israel, Egypt, and Qatar on making a deal to release the hostages in exchange for a ceasefire. It is clear that the US is running out of patience with Israel's stubborn insistence on continuing this genocidal assault on Gaza. The US leadership recognizes that it's hurting US standing in the world concerning all the international issues. But Netanyahu's right-wing government doesn't care about that. They want to continue the war because that's the only way they can stay in power. Netanyahu's at 15% in Israeli polls, and if the war stops and they have an election, he's out. And he's facing corruption and bribery charges, and he's headed for jail if this war stops. So, we can't expect much from his government, but even his government is starting to, this unity government they formed after the Hamas attack, is showing signs of breaking up. So when will the U.S. finally say enough is enough? We'll have to see what comes of this meeting. What we have to do is keep demanding that the U.S. support a permanent ceasefire and a peace process toward a political resolution of the conflict and keep the pressure on the U.S. government. Another thing going on this week is that, Speaker Mike Johnson has said the border deal is dead on arrival, which means Ukraine aid. Ukraine is running out of air defense missiles and artillery rounds to defend itself from Russia's continuing ground offenses on the front lines and its continual missile and drone strikes on civilian infrastructure and residences across Ukraine. And, you know, Biden was dumb. I mean, I don't know. It's unbelievable. He handed Johnson, the Republicans, the gun with which to kill him. And that's when he linked immigration reform to the supplemental foreign aid package. And the Republican chicken littles were running around for months saying U.S. national security is threatened by a so-called invasion of aliens at the southern border. and insisting on immediate draconian anti-immigrant measures. But now, at the urging of Donald Trump, Johnson said the border deal is dead on arrival. The far-right Republicans have decided that they don't want Biden to get credit for border reform because Trump wants to run on scapegoating immigrants for problems, of course, they had nothing to do with creating. So now the whole supplemental aid package is dead. Instead, you know, House Speaker Johnson is saying the Republicans will focus on impeaching Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, which is nothing but performative politics and not about the so-called border crisis these Republican records really don't care about anyway. The far-right Republicans in the House, they love Putin. He's an authoritarian strongman. He's got reactionary anti-abortion, anti-feminist, anti-gay, white supremacist social policies. So they're happy to cut aid so Putin can win his war of aggression in Ukraine. But what's astounding is how the pushover Democrats and their feckless leader, Joe Biden, are letting this far-right minority in the House dictate the result. What it shows, for one, is it shows why we cannot rely on the Democrats to defend our democratic rights from the fascist Republican far right. They don't know how to do it. They don't know how to fight. Biden still wants to do bipartisanship with the party that tried to overthrow his election. I mean, come on. And the fact is, in the House and in the Senate, the Democrats and at least half of the Republicans in the House and more in the Senate support aid to Ukraine. And if the aid to Ukraine was a separate vote, it would pass by a supermajority. So with the Republicans saying the aid package is dead, it's time for us to demand that the dozen or so progressives in the Senate, like those who voted with Sanders' resolution to condition aid to Israel on adherence to human rights, which is in the Leahy Amendment, it's law. Senators like Elizabeth Warren, Mazie Hirono, Chris Van Hollen, Ed Markey, Ben Ray Luan, Alphonso Butler, there are others. They should be pressuring leader Chuck Schumer to separate the supplement package into its parts and pass the Ukraine aid in the Senate and then send it to the House for an up and down vote on that question alone. And it would pass. Otherwise, Ukraine is going to be crippled in being able to defend itself. So where the hell are the Democrats? They can't defend democratic rights here or in Ukraine. The European allies, it looks like they're finally going to step up and provide their $55 billion package for Ukraine, but it's mostly economic aid, not weapons, and in the form of loans, not grants, which just increases Western economic imperialism's debt trap that is dominating Ukraine. So we've got two major wars of aggression and genocidal settler colonialism going on in Ukraine and Palestine. And the U.S. is now abetting both of them. So that's why we need a Green Party that's consistently anti-imperialist to oppose and resist both wars. Another thing happened yesterday is Biden announced a pause on the LNG export terminal in Louisiana. And I guess we should give him faint praise for that. But really, he should be castigated for having no plan to end our dependence on fossil gas for heating our buildings. Bill McKibben, back when the Russian invasion began, the full-scale invasion began, had a great proposal called Heat Pumps for Peace and Freedom. And it called on Biden to invoke the Defense Production Act so he could mandate that industry rapidly expand the production of heat pumps by U.S. manufacturers to ship them to Russia, I mean to Europe, to end Europe's dependence on Russian gas for heating. And Biden didn't do anything until November, when he did invoke the Defense Production Act and spent a paltry $169 million from the climate funding to ramp up production of heat pumps for the U.S. market, but not for Europe. What Biden's been doing is promoting the fossil fuel industry, the gas industry. So U.S. gas exported to Europe will replace Russian gas. And of course, that has really angered the Ukrainians, particularly the Ukrainian climate activists, who are demanding real sanctions against Russian fossil fuels, both for climate reasons and to undermine the funding of Russia's military machine. We had Svetlana Romanenko the Ukrainian climate activists on this podcast who, you know, explain in detail why we should be angry at this hypocrisy of the U.S. and Western Europe. And, you know, in particular, Western corporate investment in Russia's Arctic liquid nitrified gas, liquid natural gas export facilities in Russia's on the Arctic Ocean in Russia. And at the end of the year, the U.S. finally sanctioned those investments, and they've stopped from, Japan and some European companies, U.S. companies that got out earlier. China's still invested, but they're getting out for economic reasons. So that finally happened. But why the hell did it take 2 years? So yesterday, in response to Biden's pause of this liquid natural gas export facility, it issued a press release condemning Biden for failing to implement a program to replace fossil gas heating with heat pumps powered by renewable electric power. And it cited McKibben's Heat Pumps for Peace and Freedom proposal and also my Eco-Socialist Green New Deal budget estimate in the 2020 campaign that it would take $200 billion a year spent on heat pumps and associated building retrofitting to get the U.S. economy off gas heating in a 10-year rapid transition to 100% clean energy. And we'll put that press release in the chat. So, you know, what Biden did, $169 million over a few years compared to $200 billion a year that we advocated, just shows how the Biden administration is not serious about climate action. And I was reminded of this morning when I heard Jennifer Granholm, the U.S. Secretary of Energy, on MSNBC talking about this pause. And she was like saying, well, it's just a pause because coal is more greenhouse gas intensive than fracked fossil gas. And that's infuriating because she's spouting ignorance. And we've had scientists here at Cornell University near here, particularly Robert Howarth, a biogeochemist and ecosystem scientist, who has shown definitively in academic papers, peer-reviewed, that fossil gas is just as bad as coal. And I was proud that he endorsed my campaigns for governor when we called a ban on fracking and a Green New Deal clean energy transition. So climate action, if you're thinking you were going to, you know, Trump is worse than Biden, yeah, but Biden's so bad, he's not worth supporting on climate. And then the last thing I wanted to note is we got the report out this week from the U.S. Department of Labor on union organizing. And it was down again in 2023 from 10.1% to 10% of the overall workforce. And still only 6% of private sector workers were unionized. Now, they did report that the unions added 139,000 new members in 2023, predominantly from workers under age 45, but the percentage dropped again because the economy added 2.7 million jobs. So 95% of them were non-union. And this is despite in the public, unions remain at a 60-year high in terms of approval at 67%. On the other hand, only 17% of non-union workers say they're highly interested in joining a union. And 6 in 10 say they're not interested at all. And that really shows the absence of the labor movement, the unions, from being in the broader workforce and making their case for unions. And despite the high profile labor actions we saw in 2023 by the Teamsters, the auto workers, the entertainment industry workers, Starbucks staff, it's really not accurate to say that the labor movement is having an upsurge. Most of the major unions are still business unions, service unions. They're focused on servicing their existing members far more than on organizing the unorganized. And politically, most unions act as special interest groups rather than leaders in coalitions on a range of issues like housing, healthcare, education, and climate that concern working people. And most unions remain politically so loyal to the Democrats that the Democrats take their support for granted and don't feel the pressure to address labor concerns. A notable example here is the failure of the Democrats to pass the labor law reforms, the PRO Act, Protect Our Right to Organize Act, to remove many of the barriers to union organizing in federal labor law. And it passed the House, but you know, the Biden and the Democratic leadership wouldn't challenge the filibuster in the Senate. And we've had this problem both under, when the Democrats had both houses of Congress under Obama in 2009-10 and Biden in 2021-22, the failure to pass labor law reform. And Biden calls himself the most pro-labor candidate for president in American history. It's nonsense. So there are bright spots. These initiatives, organizing initiatives by young workers at companies like Amazon and Starbucks, that they're doing with little support from existing unions. And I think we also have to recognize the influence and success of the Reform Caucuses and the Teamsters and the United Auto Workers in electing new leadership, which carried out more militant action to achieve better contracts last year. Those rank and file reform caucuses in the unions are green, where green activists need to be in their unions. And I also think green candidates need to make labor law reform a top issue so they can draw the contrast between that and the failure of the their Democratic opponents to implement labor law reform. So there are many issues, and that's why we need green candidates out there, and we need to be intervening in the election cycle. I think one thing that's going on this time is there's more coverage of third parties, not just on the left with Jill Stein and Cornel West, but you know, there's the Robert Kennedy conspiracy nut contingent and then the no labels centrist corporate contingent. But with that coverage, this is a good opportunity for green candidates to get into the election cycle and the news cycle and respond. I'm happy the Green Party responded with that news release. Jill Stein put out a message to her supporters, somewhat similar to what that press release has, but not a press release. You got to talk to the reporters if you want to get covered. And I would say the same thing for Greens running at any level. You got to build a relationship with the reporters and then keep feeding them stories, positions on issues that are current in the current news cycle. And you got to be fast and nimble in order to get coverage. It moves very fast now. And I think that's something that we could all of our campaigns could work to improve on. So I will stop there and look for your comments and questions. BD Dimmitt. So if the ICC opts to decide Biden is an accessory to genocide, you mean the International Court of Justice, the DNC candidate, the Democratic candidate, would be unable to visit all those nations for fear of arrests. Well, the International Court of Justice, that's the world court, that's the UN court. I'm not sure it can call for an individual to be arrested for violating a law. The International Court of Justice deals with actions by states, but there's the International Criminal Court. Okay, ICC, I got you, BD. And yeah, the prosecutor, the chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Court is looking into charging Israeli leaders and its allies with genocide. And yes, if the process ended up with an arrest warrant, like Putin has for stealing children from Ukraine, Biden would not be able to visit countries that are members of the International Criminal Court. So yes, that is a possibility. And the arrogant American leaders, I don't think they really, it really hasn't sunk home to them that that's what could happen if they just keep joined at the hip with Israel. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure mounting and I think we're seeing a little movement, at least a little talk from U.S. leadership. And I just think that should encourage us to keep pressing on the demand for a ceasefire and a political solution and, you know, stopping the military aid to Israel. And, you know, I think put all these things together, it's going to move the needle. Faith Slayer 202, Nathaniel Gregory. Art reforms a band-aid while a revolution for a system be the way to get rid of the corporate state and replace it with a worker state with eco-socialist values. Yeah, but how do you build a revolutionary movement? I think Rosa Luxemburg's classic essay on reform and revolution, you know, the revolutionary socialists have to be in the forefront of these reform movements, which the people get behind. And the role of the socialists is to point out that a lot of these demands we have can't be met within the system. You know, a classic example there is the right to a job, a full employment economy. When you have that, there's pressure on wages to go up, and the capitalists hate that. And they are likely to go on a capital strike and wreck the economy to stop that reform. So then what's our response? You know, that's the point where a revolutionary alternative is put on the table. If the, you know, socialists are there in the movement and pointing things like that out. And at that point, you know, factory takeovers and, you know, demands for socialization of the means of production and a socialist economy become relevant to people who thought, yeah, the right to a job, that's a common sense. You know, everybody willing to work, you know, we have a work ethic. People want to support themselves. Of course, we should, you know, help make it so everybody who wants to work can work and have a job. And then when people find out it's the system that's preventing them from doing that, then they begin to say, well, maybe we need to change the system. So I wouldn't counterpose reform and revolution, except to say that reform is not enough. And we need to be in the forefront of reform fights, but also pointing out why, you know, to secure our reforms, we really need a socialist reconstruction. And, you know, we see that with things like a lot of the programs coming out of the New Deal and the Great Society. Once the capitalists, you know, regain the upper hand after periods of upheaval in the 30s and the 60s, they begin to, you know, roll back the reforms we want. Because under a capitalist democracy, the capitalists have more power. It's not just that they fund the campaigns and have all these lobbying organizations. They have control of the economy because they're the ones making the investment decisions. And they can go on strike just like workers can go on strike. And the question is, are we organized enough to strike back when they, you know, take their extra parliamentary, extra electoral actions? So, yeah, we want system change, but our demand should not be system change or nothing. We should be fighting for these interim reforms and using that, the struggle to point out to people that we got to go beyond each discrete reform to a whole new system of full political and economic democracy. Scout Trooper 164, I highly doubt a long civil war will happen. Nobody in the U.S. wants to go to war with one another. I don't know. Unfortunately, there is a far right that does want to go to war. And, you know, while it's a minority, they're armed to the teeth and looking for a fight. And we see this going on right now with, Texas defying the Supreme Court, which ordered them to take down these razor wire barriers and stop trying to implement immigration policy, which is a federal responsibility. And Governor Abbott doubled down. And I believe there are 25 states with Republican governors who have pledged their National Guard to support Texas against the feds. I mean, that's a highly dangerous situation. So I think we could have a civil war. Now, I think you're right. It's not nobody wants to go to war with one another. Most people don't. And that's what we got to count on. And we got to organize that majority to cut in the, you know, nip it in the bud so that these crazies on the right can't start something that gets out of hand. Nathaniel A. Gregory. How long till Americans realize this system is a complete shit show? You know, I think a lot of Americans realize that, you know, not just from our point of view, but across the political spectrum, people are very frustrated because they look at the, you know, the dysfunction in Congress, you know, and the inability of Biden to really lead in terms of setting the agenda and rallying people behind it. And then, you know, the system, I think maybe people are more disappointed in the leaders and don't have a good analysis of the system, you know, the role of the Electoral College and the undemocratic Senate and the extra power that the Supreme Court has taken to itself and the extra power that the, you know, the presidency has taken to itself over, you know, the last century. Those are structural problems in the political system that I don't think most people are thinking about. What they are really upset about is just nothing's getting done. And the Democrats and Republicans are losing support. There are more people now who consider themselves independent of the Democratic and Republican parties than in those parties. We have the latest Gallup poll on the question, do we need a third major party? It's at 63%. Which is a record. So I think a lot of Americans realize we got a shit show. How much they put it in the system versus the leaders we've got, I think it's more they're disappointed in the leaders. But one of the things we need to be educated about is why the system structurally undermines democracy. It's anti-majoritarian. The Electoral College, the Senate, the ability of the Supreme Court to legislate, which the conservatives who now, you know, control it always complained the liberals were doing when they, you know, supported abortion rights and civil rights. So, you know, they're hypocrites. But, you know, that's why I keep saying what we really got to focus on is breaking the spoiler problem in elections so that Greens are not marginalized by it. That means ranked choice voting, proportional ranked choice voting for proportional representation in legislative bodies. That's the start, but there are many other changes that need to go along with it. But if we get those changes, then we're going to start getting Greens in legislative bodies from city councils and town councils to state legislatures to the House. And that will totally change the political dynamic because, you know, the Greens will have a legitimate platform in the legislatures to advance our positions. And as I've pointed out many times, you look at public opinion polls on some of our major issues like Medicare for All, Green New Deal, tax the rich. The majority of people are with us, not with the Democrats or Republicans on those questions. So, you know, the elements are there for a real change. And I think ranked choice voting and proportional representation are sort of the cutting edge of how to open up the political system so we have our fair share of representation and power. Beattie Dimmitt, I believe it is important to stress the extreme difference between third-party candidates and independent candidates like RFK Jr. Party. That is most strikingly eligibility for public campaign funding and coattails for down ticket offices. Yeah, and I think you need to throw in Cornel West along with Kennedy, because Cornel is, you know, on policy about the same place Jill Stein is. In fact, I can't think of a policy they disagree on. The problem is Cornell's running a, you know, a one-off campaign for himself, whereas Jill Stein's running as part of the Green Party. And we can use that campaign to build our Green Party infrastructure from ballot lines to, you know, how we learning about how to do campaigns and, you know, reach the voters, canvas, get the vote out, and build our local organizations. So that, I think, is I would even say more important than public campaign funding. To get the public, you know, Jill should probably qualify for the primary matching funds, which we've qualified for many times in the past, which helps give us some money to help with the ballot access petition drives. That's mainly what it ends up being spent on. The public funding we get for getting 5% or more of the vote That's a bigger task. It's a much higher bar to cross. And even though there's more openness to alternatives to the Democrats and Republicans, I think the larger dynamic is going to come back to, you know, Trump or not. It's going to be a referendum on Trump, and a lot of people are going to hold their nose and vote for Biden, even though they like what the Greens stand for much more. So reaching 5%, I mean, you have to realize we had Ralph Nader, a household name, running for president for an open seat against the, at that time, compassionate conservative. That's how George W. Bush marketed himself. And Al Gore, who was continuing the corporate Clinton legacy. Real opportunity for the progressive side to really gain a lot. And Nader ended up with 2.74% of the vote. Now, that's the most an independent left presidential candidate got since Henry Wallace in 1948. In fact, it was more than Wallace got. You have to go back to La Follette. But still, 2.74% is not 5%. So I think we should aspire for 5%, but not put too many eggs in that basket, because it's going to be very difficult given our single winner-take-all presidential election system. Violet at Content Boutique. Trump keeps stirring up hate against brown and black people to his fully armed support followers. Not good. Yeah, that's Trump is egging on this far right, and you know he's ready to unleash it if he doesn't get what he wants, which is to get reelected. So, you know, that is a real concern. I see Ashley in the chat saying Henry Wallace was still a Democrat. No, he left the Democratic Party and ran as a progressive in 1948. Tried to form a third party. Scout Trooper 164, people shouldn't be bitching about the border if Trump can delay a vote to secure it, then handle it later after he plans to get elected. Shows self-interest comes first in this shit. Yeah, no doubt. They don't really care about the border. They know that, you know, we're not being invaded. You know, we have shortages of labor in the kind of jobs a lot of these immigrants are willing to work in agriculture and construction and factories. And we have an aging population. You know, immigration will be a boost to our economy. And as I've pointed out for many years, I found it to be true in our Eco-Socialist Green New Budget analysis. But it goes back to studies that were done on behalf of Ross Gelfspan, who was a editor of the publisher or editor of the Boston Globe and was doing climate studies back in the late 90s. And you got some Harvard and MIT technical people to figure out what it would take to transition to 100% clean energy. And the shortage, the bottleneck, was labor. Our Green New Deal would create so many jobs, we don't have enough people to fill them. That's where immigrants are needed, particularly in, there's a lot of construction and factory work involved in that. Plus, we want to go to, you know, sustainable organic agriculture. That takes about a third more labor than the industrialized agriculture we have now. So there are agricultural jobs there. And these are jobs that most native-born Americans are not that interested in. You know, they want a white-collar desk job, you know. And so, you know, it's hard for a lot of those jobs to keep their people filled. I mean, I know when I worked at UPS in the warehouse, high turnover. The people who stuck around were the immigrants, because for them, that was a great job with benefits compared to what they were making and wherever they came from. And I worked with people from everywhere from Iraq and Sudan to the Dominican Republic and Chile. And, you know, those people and a bunch of guys from Ghana and the Congo, you know, for them, that was, you know, really great. And so I'm just saying, you know, immigrants will be a boon, and they're not a, we shouldn't fear them. And the Republicans are just fear mongering. And actually, their business funders in a lot of these cases, like in the ag sector, you know, will tell them, you know, we don't want to cut off immigration. We need those workers. So, yeah, the Republicans are just using this as a divide and conquer thing, you know, get half the working class to blame the other half, in this case, the immigrants. And, Yeah, Vicky, it's right. Vicky Corden says immigration is a political toy for Republicans. Yep. But what's more infuriating, you expect that from these racist Republicans, is that the Democrats are not fighting back. I mean, Biden basically accepted their premise by saying, well, let's put immigration reform in the foreign aid package. You know, where are the Democrats? Where is the progressive Democratic legislation for immigration reform? It's not there. They don't have any organization around it. You just get a few sound bites from people like AOC, who's, you know, talks about abolishing ICE and then doesn't do anything about it. Scout Trooper 164, Russia is doing badly with defense. Ukraine hit their St. Petersburg oil refinery. Electricians, plumbers, etc. are dying instead of doing maintenance. Food shortages are coming in. And war is the star. I guess war meaning the star of Russian politics in Putin's re-election campaign. Yeah, I think you can add that Ukraine has basically nullified the Russian naval force in the Black Sea with their drone boats and also missile attacks. They've been able to use the Patriot missile defense system to take down the Russian fighter jets, which are more sophisticated than the F-15s that are on their way to Ukraine, apparently by 2025 at this point, way too late, and prevent them from flying up close enough to Ukraine-controlled territory to unleash missiles and gliding bombs and so forth. Ukraine also took out a couple of their surveillance planes. This is in the Azov Sea. So the Russian Air Force cannot just fly into Ukraine because of the missile defense and flatten cities like Kyiv and other big cities. So, you know, you have this narrative that, you know, Ukraine's counteroffensive failed and they're losing the war. But I think you look at the bigger picture, Ukraine has fought this big Russian army to a standstill. They've taken back half the land Russia once had. And Russia can't advance. I mean, it is a stalemate on the front line, but behind the front lines, like the oil refinery, oil depots, the military bases in Crimea, the naval fleet, the Air Force can't use the Azov Sea anymore to launch missiles and gliding bombs at Ukrainian positions in Kherson and Zaporizhia. Ukraine is doing incredibly well with limited arms. You know, the problem is if they don't get artillery rounds for the front line and get a replenishment of any air missiles, Russia is going to be able to, you know, flatten Kyiv and other big cities and, you know, just make it that much worse for the Ukrainians. That's why that U.S. military aid is important. Europe is going to step up, so Ukraine is not going to be totally without arms, but it's the U.S. that has the scale of arms that Ukraine needs. And that's why I say we should be demanding that these progressive senators start pressuring Schumer to bring a separate Ukraine aid bill to the floor in the Senate. It would pass. And when it's sent to the House, if it got to a vote, it would pass there too. But why the hell can't the Democrats get their act together to do that? It's like I say, we can't rely on the Democrats to defend our democratic rights or to defend Ukraine or really do anything that makes a difference. It's infuriating. Scout Trooper 164, I heard the EU are seeking alternatives to Russian gas and oil, meaning they may not renew the Russian deal. This would be a big win if they go through with this. The EU is seeking alternatives, and they've got contracts with Middle Eastern countries and the U.S. For gas and oil. But the fossil fuel sanctions leak like a sieve. If you go to Rosenweinstein, Svetlana Romanenko's group, they keep putting out, you know, press releases and studies showing that. Like Russian oil will go to a refinery in Greece and then be put back on a tanker, and then it's Greek oil instead of Russian oil, and it doesn't violate the sanctions. So there's all kind of holes like that. And then the gas keeps flowing. There's a pipeline through Ukraine, and Ukraine and Russia have a contract. The Russian gas goes across Ukraine to Europe. And I think it goes for another 2 years. At that point, it's unlikely either Russia or Ukraine will want to renew it. But while this war is going on, Ukraine and Russia have this deal. Russia pays Ukraine for the right to transmit its oil, its gas across Ukraine into Europe. So I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to in terms of a new deal. But what I think, and I talked about it in the opening, is, you know, U.S. could use the Defense Production Act to mandate a radical ramp up of heat pumps to send to Europe and also for our own market, so we can get off frack gas for climate reasons as well as dependence on Russian gas. Private Content Boutique. Howie, what do you think the chances are we'll all be living in domes in about 5 to 10 years from lack of serious climate action? Well, building all those domes to live in, you know, with the money that would take, we could do climate action. I don't think we'll be living in domes. I think we'll be suffering through heat waves, extreme storms, increasingly lowered food production in regions where it becomes more difficult to do agriculture, both for the heat and water reasons, also the labor reasons. There's a study out this week I read, a summary of, where the ability of agricultural workers to work in these hot climates on the equator are going to be down 30 to 40% just because, you know, it's too hot and they can't work as much or as fast or as hard, you know, just because the heat is getting to them. So that's another big thing, the impact of climate change on food production, which then will spur more migrations. And that's why we got to get a hand on the migration problem. It's global. And unfortunately, the far right in Europe, is like Trump in the U.S., is using immigration as a scapegoat for other problems that Europe is facing. And the far right is rising as a result. Ironically, the other thing that in Germany, the far right, the alternative for Deutschland, this neo-Nazi party that is, you know, growing in strength, they're also scapegoating heat pumps because they have the same line as Trump: drill, baby, drill, burn and burn and burn. And we can't let those people get in power because they'll be like, you know, throwing logs on the global climate fire. Vicky Corden, factories need to be cleaned up, their emissions also, and the technology for EV cars needs to be improved and more accessible for average and poor people. Yeah, I completely agree with that. As far as the factories go, I mean, this is why, you know, I've called for social ownership in key industrial areas so that we can force the transition faster than these industries would. Take steel, you know, they can move to electric arc furnaces and hydrogen to process the steel and get off coke ovens. But they're not going to get off coke ovens until they wear out those coke ovens. Whereas if they're socially owned, we can shut down the coke ovens, recycle, you know, the parts that are recyclable, and build, you know, electric arc furnaces and hydrogen processing to make steel that way. And that's, you know, one of many industries where this kind of thing needs to happen. But it won't happen if we leave the decisions in the hands of corporations that are out there for profit, not for, you know, making a transition to clean energy. The technology for electric vehicles needs to be improved. I think at one level it needs to be improved is we need to reduce the size. I mean, they're just replacing giant gas-guzzling SUVs with giant electricity-guzzling EV SUVs. And those are not necessary for moving people around. It's it has a lot more to do with status and mainly status, I think. And then we need to reduce the need for personal vehicles by building out mass transit in a national rail system. So like most countries have, where riding by rails is faster and more enjoyable than going to the airport, parking, going through, you know, the security and waiting and, flying somewhere. But that will require, a national rail corporation and, take over, these both the freight and the passenger rails. So the whole system be coordinated, and it requires a massive investment. So transportation and industry need fundamental transformation. And to think we can do it with little, subsidies here and tax breaks there to private industry is really not how we're going to get it done. All that is corporate welfare, is really not making a serious rapid transition to clean energy. That's why, I'm insisting that we need an eco-socialist approach. And, I hope Greens will pick that up. On paper, that's what we're for. But unfortunately, I think too many of our candidates, they run on progressive policy positions, but there's no part of the campaign saying we need system change to from capitalism to eco-socialism. And why? Because we've got to, the elections are opportunities to educate people, particularly our people, on why we need to make these radical changes. So I think that's a challenge we face. Andrew Hager, we need to push for solutions to fight back against rising sea levels, too. I propose we strategize plans to coordinate and plant oyster reefs along the coasts of every country reachable. I don't know much about oyster reefs, but I do agree that rebuilding or rehabilitating coastal wetlands is very important, particularly in a delta area like the Mississippi Delta in Louisiana, because those wetlands have been undermined by various forms of development. They're providing less of a protection from storm surges that come from hurricanes and other storms. And those wetlands are carbon sinks, and mangroves in many parts of the world are one form of coastal ecosystem that reduces carbon. And if we can have a reef growing rather than some kind of concrete or metal barrier to protect a city, that's preferable, no doubt. But oyster reefs, I'm familiar with coral reefs, but not oyster reefs. So I guess I got to look into that. The email, response to the New Hampshire primary. Well, no surprises. Nikki Haley did a little better than the polls predicted, and that was the independent vote in New Hampshire. But that won't be the option in most of the Republican primaries coming up. They're closed primaries, so that the independents won't be able to pick up the Republican ballot. So as far as the primary season goes, I think Trump has it in the bag. On the Democratic side, Howard Dean and Marianne Williamson got small totals. I think she got about 5%, and he got about 20%. And the write-in vote was 80%. And while some people were going to write in ceasefire, I think most people wrote in Biden. So Biden, There's no challenge to Biden. The progressives threw in the towel before the election started and endorsed him without making any demands. So I think the New Hampshire primary was overhyped by the cable media. That's all they could talk about for a couple of days when there was a lot of other important news going on in the world. And they talked it to death, but it was no surprise. It's going to be Trump versus Biden unless one of them croaks. And that's, the reality we're dealing with. So I don't think New Hampshire changed that in any way. Violet at Content Boutique. Water desalinization plants can help with sea level rise. Yes? I don't think so. I mean, it would take a massive amount of seawater desalinized to, and then deposited somewhere on land. And the energy required is just unbelievable. I mean, we should use that energy for heat power industry, and I'm assuming renewable energy. Water desalinization is energy intensive. And while it makes sense in certain places like the Gulf states where they have not much water but a lot of solar energy, you can do it. What's his name? Paul Glover, whose booklet, The Future of Los Angeles, envisioned Los Angeles being dependent on solar desalinization plants instead of water shipped by canal from the Colorado River, which I thought was a great idea. So it has its place, but I don't think it can reduce sea level rise. You're talking about a huge scale that, it'd be so energy intensive. And then where would you put the fresh water? You'd have to ship it by canal somewhere and, to a higher elevation. I mean, that requires pumps. It's just, I don't think feasible. Andrew Hager, cutting back on our meat consumption could help us in the long run too with factory farming. The animals we get our meat and dairy from aren't getting the proper amount of care to stay healthy. Yeah, I think we need to have farm regulations that treat animals humanely, which means we got to get away from these CAFOs, these combined feed operations. Forget what the A stands for, but they put all these cattle or pigs or chickens in confined quarters and shoot them up with antibiotics so they don't spread disease to each other, and they live miserable lives until they're slaughtered, and or miserable lives producing milk and eggs. So we need to move to a farming system where the animals live good lives. In a more natural setting, and that's going to make those products a little more expensive, but they'll be better. It will require more labor, so there's more jobs there. But the other thing is, the meat consumption, we could do with a lot less for health reasons and ecological reasons. So that's an educational problem that I think is gaining traction. A lot more people are, if not vegan, vegetarian. They're cutting back on meat and dairy. So I think we need to encourage that trend. Okay, our hour is up. So people want to talk about climate this week, which makes a lot of sense because that problem just getting worse and we're not getting any answers. I hope everybody will keep pushing on the ceasefire in Gaza and, get ready for these elections. I don't know, everybody's in different places with different situations, but this is a platform for us and we should take advantage of it. Other than that, I'll be here next week, next Saturday at the same time, and we'll have another discussion about what's going on. So have a good week, everybody.